It's August 7th, 2013, and welcome to the five-year anniversary of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ran Ozawa, and we cover the Geek Beat here on Hawaii Public Radio.
First, we'll look at the latest tech news and happenings in Hawaii and beyond. And joining us today is Todd Ogasawara from DCCA to tell us about the Hawaii Broadband Campaign.
Finally, we will explore new advances and practical applications of virtual reality and talk quite a bit about the Oculus Rift headset. We'd, of course, love your questions and thoughts as part of the conversation, so be ready to call in or tweet us. But first, the headlines.
Well, a four-month mission at the 8,000-foot elevation of Mauna Loa will come to an end next Tuesday when six researchers will return to Earth from their simulated space mission designed to study better ways to feed astronauts during long journeys. The Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation Project, or HISEAS, was led by scientists at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and Cornell University and funded by the NASA Human Research Program.
The six residents of the HISEAS habitat have been living and working like astronauts and were required to fully suit up in fake spacesuits whenever they ventured outside their simulated Martian base. When they conducted a number of science experiments related to their respective fields of study, they also worked on the main objective of HISEAS, which was to test two approaches to space food systems, pre-prepared meals versus meals assembled and cooked by the crew.
For the latter, the crews had access to a specific list of dehydrated and shelf-stable food items, and many of these recipes tested were submitted by members of the public in the Meals for Mars recipe contest. The crew has been blogging and posting updates to Twitter and Facebook, including photos and videos of meal preparation. And when they leave their Big Island base on August 13, the HISEAS team will announce the winners of the recipe contest. And I was watching some of those videos, and the food looked pretty ono. You know, they were making sushi with quinoa. Now, I was kind of wondering why they didn't use rice, but nevertheless, they had some fresh sprouts that they grew in the shelter, and they had some tofu and some broccoli and, you know, some. So it looked pretty good, but, you know, I was wondering if anybody gave them some recipes for kimchi and, you know.
Well, you know, they do. There are other studies they're doing, such as on laundry what you might smell like after wearing the same clothes for several days. And certainly odors are part of the study, in fact, like, so kimchi might factor into that. I was watching the spicy veggie sushi rolls with the sprouts that they grew in the lab. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think we've been following this project for over a year now. In fact, it was last March that Kim Binstead was on the show. So it's good to see them coming out of this. Now, in June, they announced that they got 3 more years of funding. So if you feel that you might have missed your chance to get locked up and to eat dehydrated food all day, you might still have that opportunity. What I thought was interesting is that some of them are scientists, you know, biologists, a geologist from Arizona, a journalist from San Francisco, but they even had someone who was their blog is all poetry. Mm-hmm. You know, different types of poetry, limericks, tanka, rap. So, you know, they're really trying to explore.
Well,
all
you know, I mean, this
life.
Is you're talking about a long period of time, so they got to do stuff to really amuse themselves.
I'm sure we'll hear more when they return to Earth next week. An ambitious plan to tap deep sea water to provide energy-efficient air conditioning for buildings in downtown Honolulu got a boost on Monday with a $1 million investment announcement from social investment firm Ulupono Initiative. Honolulu Seawater Air Conditioning, which was founded in 2011, is proposing a district cooling system that it says will dramatically decrease the amount of electricity currently used for cooling when it begins construction next year.
Well, the planned system will bring in cold ocean water 1,700 feet below sea level and 4 miles off Kaka'ako and use it to chill fresh water that will then be circulated through each client building's existing chilled water air conditioning system. The company says that as much as 70% of the building's electricity costs go toward air conditioning systems. Switching to seawater-based cooling in Honolulu would save enough electricity to power over 10,000 homes or reduce imported fossil fuels by a whopping 178,000 barrels a year.
CEO Eric Matsutomi said in a statement, "The missions of both organizations to create a more sustainable future for Hawaii align perfectly. Ulupono's investment represents a strong vote of confidence that the potential of our deep seawater cooling technology will greatly improve the quality of life in our island community." Honolulu Seawater Air Conditioning is also partnering with other firms that have expertise in similar systems. Capital Cooling Group, for example, a European firm that helped build an 80,000 1,000-ton system in Stockholm is also a $500,000 co-investor with Ulupono here in Hawaii.
Well, I was going to say that we've been following this story for quite a while, too. And in fact, we've had the guys from, the saltwater cooling system come on. And then there were long periods of time when it was rather quiet. Like, I didn't hear much about it. And I guess hearing now that they've got an investment by Ulupono is a good indication that they're moving forward, $1 million. But I would kind of venture to say that, this is going to cost a lot more than $1 million.
Tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah. So it is a vote of confidence. And I'm intrigued that they've had successful deployments of much larger systems in other places, Canada, Minnesota, New York.
Mm-hmm.
So it would certainly make sense here. We've got more deep seawater than we know what to do with. And Honolulu is sometimes, as a bad thing, is situated very close to the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to the electricity that they say they're going to save, I thought it was interesting that, of course, current water-powered cooling systems in downtown, all those giant chillers and stuff, are using potable water, using, fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
So by using a system like this, you're also reducing the consumption of that resource as well. Certainly something we're sensitive here about here in
mm-hmm.
Hawaii.
Well, next up, scientists looking for historical data on fish populations have turned to an unusual source, restaurant menus that tourists brought home as souvenirs. The menus were consulted as part of a larger project to fill in a 45-year gap in official records of wild fish in Hawaii waters. The researchers looked at 376 menus from 154 different restaurants. From them, they surmised that near-shore fishes like reef fish, jacks, and bottom fish were more common before 1940 than after statehood.
While those fish were found on less than 10% of menus at that point, the prevalence of larger pelagic species like tuna and swordfish grew. By 1970, in fact, 95% of the menus contained those, while inshore fish had effectively disappeared. The team notes that changes in public tastes could explain part of the shift, but by correlating their menu findings with ship landing records and socioeconomic data, that suggests that restaurant availability did in fact parallel drops in abundance in the wild.
Well, the approach is unusual in that most historical data could be characterized as supply-side information, while the menus represent the demand side. In addition to availability, they provide insights into consumption and market value as well. Lead researcher Kyle Hutton and with the Honolulu-based Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center said in a statement, market surveys and government statistics are the traditional sources for tracking fisheries, but when those records don't exist, we have to be more creative. Now, of course, I know that, when tourists come here and they go to the restaurants, it's oftentimes kind of a cool souvenir to, grab that menu and take it home. But
it's not as common now as it was before.
Yeah, that's true.
In fact, they used to make menus specifically for you to take them as souvenirs with dates on them
mm-hmm,
and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think that if you walked off with a Cheesecake Factory menu, they'd probably have a problem
mm-hmm.
with that.
Well, and of course, before, there probably were more, let's say, reef fishes, but I'm not sure how much of, the sort of the influence of things like ciguatera might have had an influence on, the reduction of reef fish as possible restaurant food, as opposed to, let's say, farm fished, let's say ta'ape or tilapia.
Yeah, but talk about a data set you wouldn't think about. And the fact that the study, I think he said he started looking for the prevalence of turtle meat,
mm-hmm,
which of
mm-hmm.
course disappeared completely after a certain point. But that's where he said, well, wait a minute, if I'm getting information about this one menu item / species, then it might help to look at it further. So a good friend of mine collects menus as well. He's got almost every menu that ever existed from the Coco Palms Hotel on Kauai.
Oh yeah.
So reading about his menu collection and some of the restaurants that he's got them from definitely can take you down memory
mm-hmm.
lane. The leading role of Hawaii astronomers and facilities in the search for planets beyond our solar system was further affirmed this week. Researchers using data from the Subaru telescope atop Mauna Kea yesterday reported finding one of the lowest mass exoplanets yet. Named GJ504b, the exoplanet is still four times the mass of Jupiter and orbits its sun at nine times the distance that Jupiter orbits ours. That makes it a significant outlier when it comes to the most common theories of planet formation.
NASA scientists use infrared data from the Subaru telescope, describing the discovery as the lowest mass detection using direct imaging. They believe GJ504b is still warm from its initial formation and likely a dull magenta or dark cherry blossom color. The exoplanet casts further doubt on the core accretion model of planet formation, which presumes that the planets form in the gas-rich debris disk around a young star, but the model does not account for large exoplanets orbiting their suns at great distances.
In related news, the University of Hawaii at Manoa last week announced the winners of its annual University Research Council Student Awards, and both of them are doctoral students at the Institute for Astronomy who specialize in exoplanet research. Brendan Bowler and Andrew Mann will each receive a $1,000 prize to support their work. Bowler has been using direct imaging to study the atmospheres of giant planets. Mann's thesis, meanwhile, focuses on finding planets around red dwarfs.
Well, of course, you know, direct imaging is seeing the exoplanet next to its sun, and they kind of describe that as like trying to take a picture of a firefly next to a searchlight.
Right.
And normally, and as we've reported on, you know, Exoplanet Palooza, that they look at the decrease in the light intensity of the sun as the planet crosses its path as a way of detecting an exoplanet. But this one is direct imaging, I guess, in orbit around the planet.
Right. And this one certainly sounds interesting. I like the description of the color. They're saying basically it's much more blue than other planets that have been imaged, so maybe fewer planets in the atmosphere. And if you're an astronomer, this star is within the constellation Virgo, and you can almost see it with your naked eye, I guess, in certain neighborhoods, mm-hmm. a relatively young star.
Well, finally, a couple of quick stories we wanted to share with you. The Pacific Island Ocean Observing System, or PACIUS, last week announced the availability of new high-resolution wave forecasts that now provide over a week of predicted wave height, period, and direction, updated twice a day. To access them, use the Surf Forecast section in the PACIUS Voyager mapping tool at PACIOOS.org/Voyager.
That's PACIOOS.org/Voyager. And Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell yesterday announced an update to the Honolulu.gov website that they say will make it easier to get an ID at its Department of Motor Vehicle offices. It has an online form that helps citizens figure out what forms they need to bring so they don't show up, stand in line, and get sent home. This upgrade actually follows the installation of live webcams at DMV locations back in February.
And of course, now joining us in the studio, and for the first time in his official capacity, it's Todd Ogasawara, and he's the broadband program specialist for the state of Hawaii's Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, and he's here to tell us about the broadband speed test campaign. Welcome to the show, Todd.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, you know, we've had you on many times as our kind of our gadget guy and our, latest sort of tech update guy. And, we usually reserve that show toward the end of the year to
Christmas shopping.
Yeah, to kind of holiday get shopping. People all primed up for buying their latest tech toys. But in terms of this official capacity, what's I guess, generating the renewed interest in doing this sort of broadband test campaign?
Well, over the past year, we've seen a lot of changes in the broadband environment in Hawaii. So, for example, we've seen cable modem speeds mm-hmm. go up from 10 to 15 megabits per second, at least on Oahu.
I think, I did a test the other day, and I think I got like 20 down.
Yeah. It's very possible. I've seen higher speeds than, they advertise on occasion. I've also seen lower speeds.
Mm-hmm. And I'm still stuck
I can speak to that.
I'm still stuck at 1 meg up.
You are right, yeah. Right. And that they limit that pretty well, mm-hmm. it appears. And on the wireless side, we've also seen LTE emerge over the last couple of years. Verizon and AT&T both launched their LTE services. So a lot of changes since the first campaign, which was January through April of 2012. Mm-hmm.
Now, we had, as part of the overall state broadband initiative, I think, talked about and encouraged people to run a speed test maybe a couple of years ago. I'm not sure. It might have even been longer than that. So a couple of questions. What are you expecting will be new or different about this round of speed testing? And did you learn anything from the first go-around?
Well, I guess I'll answer your last question first. And did we learn anything? We certainly did. We got some good data. So we have data from various locations throughout the state that tells us, where what kind of speeds people are seeing. Now, of course, the download and upload speeds that people see vary from time to time, day to day, and place to place, wherever they might be visiting. Mm-hmm. So it's a highly variable kind of thing. And so unlike other tests, we encourage people to take it as often as possible, mm-hmm. at different times of day, different days of the week, different conditions, just to give us more data of what's going on. To answer why, again, we've just seen a lot of changes in the broadband sphere, and we'd like to get more data to kind of do a before and after test. What's changed since early 2012?
Now, with the data that you might gather as a result of this campaign, will it be something that would perhaps influence policy? Would it influence any sort of deployment? Will it attract Google Fiber to come into Hawaii? I mean, what is the goal here?
Sure. So the goal is to inform us, everybody, about what our broadband really looks like and where we need improvement, mm-hmm. where it doesn't exist because we'll see pockets of no tests. And we know, from the various broadband providers where they do not have service. So we can use this data to go back to the federal government and get more money, go back to our state government and try to encourage broadband type initiatives.
Now, you know, the Governor Abercrombie has an initiative, the Gigabit Initiative, which really is trying to promote the idea of getting gigabit to everybody by 2018. And this is, this is a kind of, I don't know if it's hypothetical, but, the wish is that you could get gigabit up and down or close to symmetric. I would take 100 meg up and down. I don't need a gig. But I guess the question is, Todd, is there enough motivation by the public to really want that kind of speed? Are they satisfied with what they currently have? And what is it going to take for them, the public, to want more?
Well, that's a couple of questions, but let me try to answer them as best I can. And that's, first, does the public know what they want? And we're actually trying to find that out right now. So we have a couple of projects going on as we speak to try to get to the public. And in fact, at some point in the near future, you may be getting a phone call from a survey company working on our behalf, a marketing company working on our behalf, to ask you about what your broadband experience is like today in 2013.
Now, I don't even have a home phone, so I wonder, a lot of people who are really into internet technologies might not be reached by a phone survey, but still, it's good to see the data collection.
Actually, let me address that question or that comment too, and that is the survey companies actually do take that into account, and they will actually be splitting the survey 50-50 cell phone numbers versus wireline.
Now, will this data be frequently updated and publicized? Will we be able to
sort
of
see
a heat map? Will it be open? Although I can also see that if you were either Oceanic or Hawaiian Tel, that maybe you don't want a happily populated map of your customers' speeds or lack thereof around the state.
Okay, so I can actually address that one too.
Okay.
We actually, our data that we collect is actually available right now on a map. And you can find that at highbroadband.org. More importantly, because our work at DCCA is funded by an ARRA grant from the NTIA, is that the data is collected nationally. And so you can go to the National Broadband Map website and see all kinds of great data. In fact, they just updated it with the December 2012 data set that was collected a while back. And they have cross-referencing with economic information and providers. And in fact, even on both maps, our map and the NTIA's map, you can see where providers provide coverage.
Do they give it in fairly raw form as opposed to already placing it on the map?
Yes, they do. The NTIA, let's see, it might be the NTIA, it might be the FCC, I can't remember now, but one of them, there's a link on the National Broadband Map, allows you to go and download raw data for by state or nationally that is available, I think, in a CSV file, common delimited file that you can import into whatever program you want, as well as Esri shape files that you can use with a free program like ArcGIS Explorer.
Cool, very cool.
All right, so once again, if someone wants to contribute to this growing data set of broadband speeds, where should they go?
Let me make sure I get this right now. Let me look at my notes. It's a long one. HIBroadbandMap.org.
Broadbandmap.
Yes, HIBroadbandMap.org.
Okay, fantastic. And we'll definitely put it on our show notes. And Todd, how long do they actually Participate? I mean, how long is this campaign going to go?
The actual speed test is available year-round, mm-hmm. but we're going to be pushing it for the next couple of months so we can do, like I said, okay. You know, before and after kinds of comparison.
Sounds good. Thanks, Todd, for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on.
And that's what's been happening this week. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be joined by Kai Kao and Emil Reyes to talk about virtual reality.
What's new in the field of VR? Is this technology becoming accessible to the consumer? We'd, of course, love your thoughts or questions as part of the conversation, so please give us a call at 941-3689 or toll-free from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689.
And, of course, we're also monitoring Twitter. You can tweet us at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Long lines, angry, miserable customers, and then there's this.
To me, the DMV is the lowest paid, you know, state agency that, you know, is out there. And I think, wow, and we collect the most money.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, Life at the DMV. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
This evening at 6, following Bite Marks Cafe.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I am Maurizio Benazzo, co-founder of Science and Non-Duality Conference. Next time on New Dimension, I'll be talking about science and spirituality.
Sunday morning at 11.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ran Ozawa.
And joining us today is Kai Kao and Emil Reyes. And Kai is an independent internet entrepreneur, musician, and founder of the Hawaii Virtual Reality Club.
And returning tonight is Emil, the founder of Rapid Technologies, LLC, and of course a longtime proponent of all kinds of visualization technology.
And where has virtual reality come from? Of course, from the early days. I don't want to mention Second Life, but I guess I will. of course, we'd love to hear your comments and questions. And, of course, that number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Kai and Emil, we want to welcome you both to Bite Marks Cafe.
Thank you.
Aloha. Thanks for having me.
So we'll start a little bit, with a background from Emil about VR, virtual reality, and some of the headsets that you've been dealing with from your experience and work with the military and various kinds of employment that you've been involved in. I mean, so tell us kind of where did you get your start in VR?
Okay, well, you know, VR, as soon as I saw it, I was interested just from a fun perspective. But, you know, I think I've been involved with VR since the early 90s. Mm-hmm. I got my introduction to it when I was in the Army. We were looking at ways, well, one, we received a lot of simulation training. This was mostly at the Mounted Maneuver Battle Space Lab at Fort Knox, Kentucky. So a lot of our training had to do with driver training, combat training. They were the premier development laboratory for soldier training solutions, and virtual reality was obviously what they did. They had everything from I remember we worked on a system where it was you pedal to move forward, a bike motion system. We did scout recons where it was virtuality built into binoculars. And, you know, I remember going in and just raiding CompUSA and just emptying their shelves of stuff so these guys would build stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, of course, you know, that was very specific. And, you know, back in the day, it, you know, VR was just way too expensive for anybody to really have fun with. The Battle Space Lab had endless cash flow to start developing things. And they were actually working on some of the first network simulators before it became commonplace in video games. And then I remember when I was leaving, the first network, truly networked virtual worlds came out. I think it was World War II Online actually beat them to creating a networked virtual battlefield.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, you know, from there, you know, driver simulating, we really had to look a lot at syncing the driver's training experience with actual motion. And so from that I got to learn a lot about virtual reality and how it affects the actual person. I mean, that motion sickness and that experience of reality motion and the virtual world and trying to sync all that in the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll definitely talk about some of the effects of virtual reality.
Yeah.
Kai, I mean, how did you get started in this sort of world of virtual reality?
Well, basically, I saw the Oculus Rift on Kickstarter.com. You've heard of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fundraising platform, crowdsource. And I saw it on day two and knew that it was going to change the world dramatically. And hasn't done it yet, but I think it's going to very shortly.
Now, you know, in terms of virtual reality and Emil, you talk about, you know, your sort of beginnings. The screen image, and I want you to talk a little bit about this. There's different ways of viewing a virtual reality screen, right? I mean, you could see it on your computer. You could see it on your, perhaps your laptop, like, you know, like things like, I don't know, Second Life and Blue Mars,
3D glasses perhaps.
Yeah, but
you can have it projected on a wall,
right? And or in a let's say like in the driver's in a sort of preconceived driver's console.
Yeah,
you know, and sort of it's like almost like a game console where you're immersed inside a unit. So there's a number of different ways that you could be viewing the screen itself, and then of course you have these headsets that put you totally into this immersive environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I'm curious, how would you differentiate all those different sort of categories?
Well, industry-wise, there's augmented reality, there's virtual reality, and there's mixed reality. And then there's basic simulation, which is simulations based on a known degree of error. But for, you know, augmented reality is when you're doing an overlay of additional information on the real world. It can be entertainment, it can be numbers, it can be anything. Virtual reality really being an immersive experience where the goal is to make that person feel like they're in a different reality. Mixed reality is a combination of the two. Usually it's like augmented reality and a little bit of sometimes you have even just projected surface mixed reality. It's a lot of it is still kind of fringe as far as definition, but those are usually when you talk industry standard, those are the three different ways that you separate it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kai, you founded the Hoi Virtual Reality Club. You had your first meeting about a month ago, and it was talking specifically about that platform, the Oculus Rift platform. And I have to say that, you know, even I recall, I'm not as old as Bert, but I recall seeing virtual reality headsets, which look like big, giant goggles on your head and people sort of waving their arms around a room. And that was, you know, 70s, 80s. And I was kind of fascinated that in some ways the Oculus Rift is just about as large and, you know, visible. It's you know, it's not like Google Glass, for example, which we talked about a few weeks ago. So how do you see that being either a hindrance to its marketability or something that's just always going to be the case, that in order to fill someone's field of view, they're going to have a big box on their face?
Right. So just to address this for the listeners out there, the Oculus Rift is about 379 grams on your face. So it's pretty light compared to everything that's come before. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you're spot on.
Basically, we've made a lot of huge jumps and bounds in the technology since, you know, the 90s. And since we had movies like The Matrix and Lawnmower Man showing us what virtual reality should look like.
Right.
You know, back then we didn't really know how it should look like. We had this dream. But I think now with Oculus Rift, we're finally there. And I think it's only going to get a lot better. And it's happened really because of the phone market, right? The little displays and the smartphones. That's really what made this possible, made it so lightweight. And I don't think it's going to be that big of an issue, because when you put the goggles on, you're not really worried about what people outside are going to think. You're wearing them because you want to be inside your favorite game. You know, you wear them because you want to walk through Skyrim and look at some dragons, you know, in a way you could never do before, at a price point you could never, you know, pay for before.
So you kind of attribute the technology and the advances with Oculus Rift with what has been, let's say, done with cell phones and the high-resolution screens that are now becoming available. And I did notice that we did put it on, and it was pretty light. I mean, I kind of thought it would be heavy and maybe
it looks heavy, but it's not.
Yeah, you know, have a actual impact on your neck or something. But it was actually pretty light. So are there other technologies that are coming to bear right now that is making a unit like Oculus Rift sort of the right time to be into the VR technology?
Yeah, I think so. Because if you think about it, The Oculus Rift was invented by this 18-year-old kid named Palmer Luckey in his garage, and he didn't think anybody was going to find much interest in it, but he went to Kickstarter. He got some support by John Carmack, who's, you know, famous for the Doom franchise. And after raising $2.4 million on Kickstarter, they were able to prove that people want this now. And it happened in this kid's garage. It didn't happen at Microsoft or Apple or, you know, some big corporation. And so that just goes to show that it wasn't really something we could do until now, mm-hmm. you know. And it was just about this kid happening to find out the right way to do it, which was, interestingly enough, using mobile phone, you know, smartphone screens, mm-hmm. which just didn't exist 5-6 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Kai Kao and Emil Reyes about Oculus Rift and virtual reality. And if you remember Lawnmower Man, or if you have visions of what the future could be like using this technology, we'd, of course, love to hear from you. 941-3689, or from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. Now, Kai, again, as Bert said, was kind enough to let us have a test drive. And you have this box on your face, but once it's filling your field of view, it is actually very impressive. And I think what made the difference, and Emil, you can talk about this a bit, is the latency. Now, the last time I remember putting something like this on, it was in a medical facility somewhere in Waikiki, and it was great to have these goggles on and turn my head to the left and see something to the left, but there's like, just even if it was a tenth of a second or half of a second between when I turned my head and the screen actually represented that turn, mm-hmm. that was enough to kind of take you out of that universe. It was almost like you're walking through water or in slow motion. Mm-hmm. And I think that if there's anything that's key to the success of these, is that it feels real.
You know, and, you know, something, you know, thanks to Kai, this is the first time I've got to wear the Oculus Rift. Before this, I've used Imagine headsets. I've used a bunch of the industry standard ones. And weight and size are a big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just hard to get immersed into something when you have some huge device on your head that's weighing your neck down. And, you know, latency, any little thing that throws you off in a virtual world, I mean, it just ruins the experience for you. So, the closer you come and removing that latency and just feeling like you're just a normal guy sitting around looking around. I mean, some of the demos you showed me the day with how effective the system is, it's extremely impressive. It's some of the most impressive VR I've seen so far.
Now, you know, Kai, you were showing us, an example of a view, kind of like a 360 view. Can you tell us a little bit about what went into developing that? In fact, you did that on your own with your own software and application.
Yes. So basically, I've been working on this image host. It's kind of like Flickr or Imgur, if you've heard of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Basically, you need a place to upload files, whether it's videos or pictures or, you know, whatever you're trying to upload and share with people. And basically, my site is an image host for places. So if you take a picture, right, say, for example, right here in this room, and you take a picture, you upload it to my website, you can view that picture in London as if you're actually there. It's kind of like visual teleportation, but it's something that you couldn't do on a computer screen. I mean, we could before. You can look at a house or rental property. They take 360-degree pictures. You could look at some pictures on a screen, but you don't get the feeling that you're there. You know.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I've been sort of viewing is something called a photosphere. And so a lot of people have been uploading their 360-degree sort of photosphere images of places that they've been. Viewing it on the computer is a little bit, I don't know, not nauseous, but, you know, you sort of have to get used to the image sort of moving across the screen.
Right.
But the one that I saw on yours, I don't know how similar or different it is to a photosphere image, but it, because it's immersive, it felt more like I was there.
Right.
And so, is photosphere something like what you're describing, where they could do?
Photosphere is very similar. My website uses seamless equal rectangular format images, which means, like, you know, if you have the Earth, which is a sphere, and you unwrap it onto a 2D plane, you have a two-dimensional map, you know, like we have in most schools. And that's the format that you need, because when you put it through my software, it stretches it back onto the sphere, puts you on the inside of that sphere, and lets you look around the inside as if you were there. But it's very much like Photosphere. The only difference is that I'm using images that are captured using higher quality camera rigs rather than smartphones using their accelerometers to stitch together the pictures. Because right now we're still not really there, I don't think, with the quality of the images you can get versus the quality of the images you can get from, you know, an SLR camera rig or something. Mm-hmm.
Well, I can certainly see the appeal of visiting places virtually. I mean, that's one of the appeals of Google Glass is I could visit Paris and do a hangout and let my friends watch me as I walk through Paris. But and you could do now a photosphere near the Eiffel Tower and be able to look up and down and see everything. Emil, I mean, there are a number of different applications for this, from military to tourism. My interest, perhaps for my day job, would be real estate. And why can't I do a full walkthrough of a property and see the nooks and crannies, perhaps things that a homeowner wouldn't want me to see as a buyer? where do you think the heart of it is? Because Oculus Rift, I think, is being presented as a gaming platform. Is that how it's going to get into the mainstream?
Well, getting to the mainstream, always looking at as a business, I think where its target is perfect, and that's for entertainment. You know, the gamers, I think, are going to embrace this the most, and that's where it's all started. I think it's going right. It actually, you know, between when these type of things develop, these visualization technology develop, there's two markets that they usually work for, and that's one, entertainment, and then a very specified market, which is like medical or somebody who really knows how to take advantage of it and sells it to another market.
Mm-hmm.
The Oculus Rift is looks like it's already targeted. It was developed by the community that wants it. And so that, I think, is where it's going to go crazy, and it's up to other developers to start using it for more practical purposes. And the reason that it excites me is just because of its price point. Usually something that has this type, there's never been a virtual reality device that seems to have the community that's growing around this thing.
So what was the price point? I know earlier you're talking about some of the units that the military was involved in, and you know those were fairly expensive. How has the price come down with respect to Oculus Rift?
I'll let Emil cover what the price used to be. And then
okay.
Kai definitely knows more about the Oculus, the older stuff before. Like on the market, I remember the Imagine headset, which is between $800 and $950. The last I checked, and that was about a year ago. And that was it wasn't that immersive. It had the head tracking, but there was some latency. I have one of those units, and that was considered the best consumer unit for the price. Anything after that was close to that quality was probably past $1,000. Professionally, when I was working for the military, one we were evaluating was one by a company called Sensix. And that was I don't remember the specs on that, but the pricing for that was over $100,000.
That's a far cry from from Oculus Rift.
So the Oculus Rift is $300. Mm-hmm.
So
huge price drop.
Very exciting, yeah.
Very exciting.
Now, are there other things about Oculus Rift that is making, let's say, the developers really excited? Is there a common interface that they're now accessing? Is it easier to program for?
So the developer community is amazing. I mean, they're very active on the Meant to Be Seen 3D forums, which is where this all kind of started, but also on Reddit. You know, there's a really strong subreddit there with already over 10,000 subscribers, and I think that makes it the fastest subscribed subreddit in history. But the community is great. The developers have many reasons to be excited. I'm excited personally because this is the first time that I've been this excited about a technology before, you know, where I've been driven to, you know, start a club, get people interested, bring people together to make stuff for the platform, you know. I can't think of anything else that would have made me want to go do all this stuff. You know, it's crazy.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about the local meetup and some of the ideas that might have been thrown around and some things that perhaps local developers might be able to make for Oculus Rift and other platforms like that. But we'll hold that thought. We'll be back after this short break to continue our conversation with Ka'i Ka'u and Emil Reyes about the applications of virtual reality.
And, of course, we want to find out why you got so excited. And of course, if you're out there with an Oculus Rift, we want to hear why you are excited. And of course, that number to call is 941-3689. on Oahu or from the neighbor islands at 1-877-941-3689. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Feel the blues with Dion Boogie Scott as he pays tribute to his guitar hero, Eric Clapton. In the Atherton studio on Saturday, August 17th, Boogie, Hawaii's own blues guitarist and singer-songwriter, will perform his personal favorites in an evening with Clapton. That's August 17th at 7:30 p.m. You can make your reservations at hawaiipublicradio.org or at 955-8821 during business hours.
On the next On Being, we're fascinated with outer space, but the bottom of the ocean is just as alien, just as mysterious.
And keeps us alive, oh, by the way.
Oceanographer Sylvia Earle has walked on the bottom of the sea, and she takes us there with singular urgency and passion. I'm Krista Tippett. Please join me. That's from APM.
Sunday morning at 10.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ran Ozawa, and we're talking to Kai Kau and Emil Reyes about the current state of virtual reality.
And, of course, we want to get to why Kai is so excited about the Oculus Rift. And, of course, you can give us a call at 941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Now, I know there's technology like, let's say Google Glass. People look at that. The price point, of course, was a little high, and it was kind of a barrier to a lot of people who wanted to maybe get involved. But, of course, that's just a pilot, and I think it's going to come down in price, and people are talking about, you know, it being in sort of that $200, $300 range. For Oculus Rift to be at the $300 range, I think it's very let's say the barrier is very low. But there's other things, Kai, that probably were really attracting you to this, to the extent where you would form the virtual reality club and get others sort of involved with, you know, with working with the Oculus Rift. I mean, could you characterize where that excitement was really coming from? I mean, what is it about the equipment that seems to be sort of spawning this excitement?
So it's probably the dream, you know? I mean, we've been waiting for virtual reality for a long time. I mean, I have, ever since I saw The Matrix, you know. But basically, I'm really excited because you don't have to be, you know, working at some AAA studio or working for Sony or Microsoft to have the chance to work with this stuff. Mm-hmm. You just need $300 and some time to either learn how to program and design a game or an experience. You know, and if you have the passion to do that, now's the time to do that because the platform's so new. You know, somebody in Hawaii could make the next Pac-Man or the next Tetris, you know, in a weekend maybe.
So when you bought your Oculus Rift, was there some programming that you had to learn in order to program the unit, or was it something that was fairly straightforward out of the box?
So there's multiple ways to write software for the Oculus Rift. You can use development kits, Unreal Development Kit or Unity or Torque 3D. And if you use those tools, they're a lot more user-friendly than trying to, you know, hard program something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty drag and drop also. So you can just drag and drop the preset, make a game that originally wasn't designed for the Oculus Rift. You can just drag and drop a little thing in. And now it'll work, you know. So that's pretty cool. But me personally, I was able to write my software in about a week after just reading up on the SDK, the development kit, how stuff works. They're really nice with just explaining everything, very mm-hmm. straightforward. This is how you do that. This is how you do that. You know, and you want to learn how to do this, just type it into YouTube, and you'll find 10 tutorials explaining how to do it. No.
So now you've only had one meeting of the club, but I'm sure there will be more. And you did, for example, interact with a lot of the members of the programming and developer community here in Honolulu already. I like when you said that it's almost the excitement of a new platform is clear, whether you were the first mover on iOS App Store or you're the mm-hmm. first great app on Google Glass before it goes mainstream. If it goes mainstream, you're well positioned. So at this meeting or perhaps in your conversations with other locals, what did you hear? What cool ideas, perhaps specific to Hawaii do you think that we could execute well?
Okay, so specific to Hawaii, I think surfing apps are really cool. So anything related to surfing would be pretty interesting. But I really don't know. I think it's really up to the community to come together and decide what do we want to do, you mm-hmm. know?
Now you got me thinking. Now, if you were to put together a surfing, let's say, image or, you know, multiple 3D views, how would you actually go about doing that? Would you be on the surfboard sort of taking as many shots as you can? I mean,
You'd probably want to use a Google car, sort of like camera, you know, Google Maps tracker. That would probably be sufficient.
I was wondering if that would be something that you could either simulate with something like that, or if you would just use computer simulations, although I would imagine water physics is relatively difficult. But yeah. I could certainly see that idea. Now, Emil, there are some downsides, as there is to almost any new technology. And, you know, I'm certainly keying off the fact that although it's light and although it's comfortable, it still is not, you know, the sexiest piece of hardware you've seen. It's not something that you would necessarily want to play in public. But the other thing is that a lot of people, even testing the Oculus Rift, get a little dizzy because when you're surrounded by an environment that doesn't match up to what the rest of your body thinks is happening, you can have motion sickness. Yeah. Is that overcomable, or is that always going to be a challenge with these technologies?
I think with the developers, what they've got to realize is that with new technology, you've got to really learn the tool sets. You know, for example, one of the things that we discovered when doing simulators is you can have the movement and the images have to match, and that, you know, that's something that you really gotta get right. And then you can have such thing as too much clarity, too much motion going on, that basically there's a point that the human brain cannot comprehend everything going on, especially if it's not matched, where people get sick. And there are also people, I'm sure you've seen the warnings on like strobe light effects that, you know, people who have had seizures before shouldn't. Everybody's different.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to use this, you know, there should be some warnings, and developers need to understand how to make the graphics that is probably will reach the broader audience. And I would say it would help the best if they want something successful. But putting too much on the screen is just as bad as putting too little sometimes.
Now, when you were put the headset on and you were viewing sort of this roller coaster ride, watching it, you know, standing there looking at the laptop monitor, I could get my bearing, and I wasn't, you know, I didn't feel like I was getting tossed around. But when you're wearing the headset and you're actually kind of in this 3D environment, and, of course, on a roller coaster ride, you sort of feel like you're moving around.
Yeah.
I mean, so in that short period of time that you were watching that, did you get any sense of, you know, sort of the motion? And
I think if I would have used it in the right environment and, you know, everybody was talking at the same time, I think I could have got into it and been a lot more immersed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I happen to have a slight aversion to heights, a natural slight aversion to heights. And what was great is when we came over that first hill, I felt a little in my knees. I was like, that's one. And I told myself, this is great. This is awesome. I can actually, actually fooled my brain.
Ah, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
We're talking to Emil Reyes and Kai Kau about virtual reality and the Oculus Rift headset. And if you're curious about this up-and-coming technology, this is your chance to call and ask about it. 941-3689 or from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. Now, Kai, I liked what Emil said about sometimes it being, you know, you might not want to be too realistic. And in fact, I was just reading an article about a new game that's being developed, like a first-person shooter where you're walking around in a world, and the creator of the game was like warning people that you might get so comfortable in this world that you might think there's a crate or a railing that's in the game and in front of your face, but you might try to lean on it or, you know, put some weight on it and it's not there and you'll fall flat down. I mean, do you see that as actually probably one of the more amusing but perhaps bigger challenges of a fully immersive headset?
Are you talking about the Hydra Deck?
Yeah, I think that was it.
So he's using positional tracking to track his body and stuff, and ducking over crates and barrels, kind of like Time Crisis.
Right.
I think that we're going to see actually larger play areas. I mean, sure, you can set up a little play area in your house, but if you go to a larger area, say, that has room for 8 people to be playing side by side simultaneously, I think that's a lot safer than... I mean, there were issues with the Wiimote, too. You know,
you're right.
People
right.
throwing the Wiimote into their televisions.
You know, I saw something recently announced where they integrated the Oculus Rift and a Kinect and a stationary bike. It's called Paper Dude VR. And it showed the guy, there's a little video of the guy.
The old Paperboy game,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Paperboy. And he's riding his stationary bike and he's throwing papers you know, down the road. And I thought that was kind of cute. I mean, it's a good way to work out and maybe just, you know, get a sense that you're a Paperboy. But I think it's kind of interesting that there's, you know, this integration between like a Kinect, which detects your body motion, and then also Oculus Rift that gives you the display. And it's all kind of integrated into the screen and sort of you're experiencing this thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that kind of where it's going?
Yeah, and for multiple uses, you know, you can use the same Oculus Rift headset to play Paperboy and get exercise on your bike, and then switch over to your Virtuix Omni treadmill, stationary treadmill, and go for a jog through Skyrim or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how it's getting connected to exercise also, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe in the future, gamers aren't going to be couch potatoes. They're going to be athletes because they spend all day running around in virtual worlds.
Well, you know, so if somebody goes out there and buys an Oculus Rift, what kind of computer do they need in order to run the software that you're going to be looking at on the image screens?
So for the development kit... basically, you need a computer that can pull 60 frames per second, so you need a pretty nice graphics card. But I'd say almost hold off until the consumer version comes out, unless you're interested in developing for the platform, because by then computers will have dropped in price and gotten better. But
so the $300 unit that you have is more of a developer unit?
Yes. The kit I have is a developer kit, and they've shipped over, I think, 17,000 worldwide so far,
mm-hmm.
Shipping more every day. They can't really keep up with demand, actually. So
the consumer kit will not have any developer tools with it?
No.
Okay.
But the consumer Rift will be at lowest resolution, 1080p. So HD goodness.
Wow.
And there's cool stuff you can do with that where you can simulate a movie theater, right? I showed you that.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
How was that?
That was excellent. That was the best I've ever seen.
Yeah.
We had a shy caller who wanted to know specifically how to find information on the Oculus Rift. And although Kai will probably give that at the top or the end of the show, it's OCULUSVR.com, the Oculus virtual reality helmet. So, Emil, it's good to me that you have this long background and experience working with some of these other headsets, you know, and we're now talking things that used to cost $90,000 coming down to $300, perhaps less. Do you think that there is that path forward? Gaming might be where this gets into people's living rooms, but there are a lot of people who play games that are still not considered, you know, mainstream. Mm-hmm. The Wii might still be kind of a little odd, or the Kinect might not be something that your average person has. Is games really the best channel for this, or is it okay that it's not going to be something that everybody's going to want?
Well, there's successful and then there's life-changing. The iPhone was life-changing, not just because it was a successful device, but because it had a much broader appeal to a much broader audience. People who weren't even interested in cell phones were interested in iPhones for what they could do for them. Now, the Oculus Rift, it is targeted at gaming. And as any technology has shown us, I think that we need to find more practical purposes. We're looking at what we call the convergence of certain technologies, and what Kai pointed out before. And it is a beautiful time right now because all these tools for developers are becoming affordable. In virtual reality, the Oculus Rift being priced so low, it's funny, people scan with Microsoft Kinects now. The Kinect before it's a time of flight camera basically, and before the Kinect, the cheapest time of flight camera, and I was looking to purchase one at one time, was $50,000. And it was funny when the Kinect was announced, all of a sudden the company that made that $50,000 said, oh, we have one for $120 now.
Wow, really dropped in price.
Yeah, really. It's big surprising. And it's the same thing with the Oculus Rift. It's disruptive technology, disruptive to a lot of the established companies and stuff. But it's good because it allows everyday people to be able to develop and broaden the uses. And that's really what it needs to become to be life-changing is mm-hmm. we need people now who can develop this for medical applications. I'm excited because I think this will help me. I do a lot of 3D modeling for product development mm-hmm. and I use a 2D screen. I think it'd be great to, actually use a comfortable headset to help me design something faster. To be able to look at it in a three-dimension, design it faster.
But again, it's kind of a niche market, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious to hear if you have any ideas how an application that would start to really impact the masses. I mean, what might that be?
I think there's plenty. Kai has tapped into the virtual tourism market. I think that's a wonderful idea, what you're doing. I think you should keep running with it. there's that training. Training has always been the first thing I got introduced with it. Mm-hmm, training, mm-hmm. I mean, it was reserved for military when I first used it. But now we can get people, somebody who's an expert in something else that would need you to be hands-on can now simulate it and share it with the masses a lot easier and more cost-effectively now. So training, I think, is wide open. Surgical training.
Telepresence.
I've been looking – that's it. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. Telepresence. I was looking before at a scanning telepresence solution for crime scenes. That's someone I was talking to, a law enforcement person, about that before. How do we do telepresence for crime scenes? And we were talking about scanning with the Kinect, and I can imagine now viewing it with an Oculus Rift.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine a whole jury box filled with jurors wearing an Oculus Rift and walking through mm-hmm. instead of all of those charts and graphs on easels that they have to kind of mm-hmm. imagine for themselves what the space is like.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, Kai, you just got this club started. You're very excited about the Oculus Rift. What is next on your plan to continue to bang the drum? Is there a specific niche that you're going to chase or a partner that you're seeking to connect with?
So basically what I want to do is have a meeting every 2 months or so and out of High Capacity down by Box Jelly, right? Same building. And hold contests every couple months and demo days to show off, software that maybe people in the club have been working on. Just create a good place for innovation to happen. And an outlet for people to get their work noticed,
And it seems you're free in allowing random, perhaps not the best smelling geeks, try on your headsets. I think that's also certainly a plus.
Well, I wipe it with the cloth every time.
All right. So where can someone go to find information on the Hawaii Virtual Reality Club?
We'll be posting an update on highcapacity.org. So
fantastic.
Sounds good.
And Emil, if someone wanted to learn more about your visualization approaches and technology, where can they go?
Thinkrapid.com.
Thinkrapid.
Great. Kai Kao is the founder of the Hawaii Virtual Reality Club, and Emil Reyes is the CEO of Rapid Technologies. We want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. This is a lot of fun.
And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we'll talk to a couple of asteroid hunters.
And if you missed any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. And if you have any comments or suggestions, email us at feedback@bitemarkscafe.org. Or, of course, you can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Bite Marks.
And you can follow me at Hawaii. Our engineer is David Chong, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Koslovich.
And we leave you with our song pick of the week. Here's a band called Articulate and a song called Boom. See you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.